This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Patricia Harris grew up in a military family. Participation in the juniors program at the local American Legion Auxiliary wasn't optional. Her dad was a Legionnaire. Her mom was in the auxiliary. No, she was going to be in that program. So when she graduated from Broughton High School in Raleigh, it was a natural progression for her to join the Army. Patricia Harris never imagined that years later she would break down barriers and serve as the first female and first African-American commander of North Carolina's American Legion, and she joins us now. Commander Harris, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you, and let me first thank you for your service.
Quite welcome. We'll do it all again.
Well, tell us about your family background and your military involvement, their military involvement.
Well, you know, my father, World War II veteran, and then I had uncles, you know, that was served in Korea, and other cousins and relatives that served in Vietnam and other wars. And why not? You know, I wanted to wear my father's American Legion cap. I used to put it on quite a bit when I was little, and he used to tell me that I had 2 minutes to wear it. And I asked him about that 2 minutes, and he told me that it's a responsibility that comes along with wearing the American Legion cap. And when I got a little older, because when you're a kid, 2 minutes is a long time, but when you start to get older, why, Dad, only 2 minutes? And he said, if you want to wear this cap, you have to earn it. And earn it how? You earn it by putting your life on the line, you know, and willing to die for your country, to die for what we believe in the United States. That sparked a difference for me. And so when I made the decision to want to join, it wasn't quite easy because I thought one time I wanted to be a firefighter, but I didn't pursue it. I'm not going to say that no one discouraged me. I just didn't pursue it. I thought about it. Okay, I'm African-American, 17 years old. Firefighter, I don't know, but I kind of talked myself out of it.
We also wanted to be a hairdresser.
Wanted to follow in my mother's footsteps and be a hairdresser. And one of the instructors there, she's not around anymore, Miss Christiana Pitts, she told me, she said, you know what, you're young. Now I'm 18 years old. She said, you should pursue whatever your dreams are, because I didn't want to go to college and have my parents try to pay for it. And I know what kind of student I was in high school. It wasn't that great, but I didn't want my parents responsible for it. I would want to take care of it myself. And so I talked to her, and she said, you can always come back and be a hairdresser. You're young. Now would be the good time for you to go and serve your country. If that's what you want to do, go do that. I have a feeling that that's what you really, really want to do. And so off I went.
Off you went, and you ended up serving in the first Gulf War, right?
I sure did.
What kind of work did you do? Communications, right?
I was in communications. We were the first, what they call the MSC, and that's mobile subscriber equipment communications. And it's equivalent to you using a cell phone, except for we was on the battlefield. So I can tell you we had GPS, how ancient all of this stuff was at that time, and real bucky telephones and GPS units that we used out in the desert.
It's a good thing you didn't have all those other apps we have now, or that we might not have won. Everybody would be playing games on their iPhone. You weren't playing games, and it was very serious duty out there. But in fact, you were a woman who was in charge of this kind of equipment and communications, and initially you met some resistance, didn't you?
Of course. I'm sorry, but I was just one of those women that was not serving traditional role. I joined many other women that serve in non-traditional roles. Wanted to be outside, worked very well outside, and of course, again, it was more male-dominated, but I knew that. I wasn't looking for a husband. I was just looking for a job, you know, and trying to do the best that I could be to support the missions of our United States and keep us safe.
You had a male infantry unit that simply didn't want women on the front lines. And tell us about that, because you were in communication. So if you're not there, they're not communicating, right?
Absolutely. It was almost hilarious after being rejected on many times. Well, we don't want a female communication team here. We don't care that you're the best. they didn't want us. You know, they just said, well, I have 400 men here, and I'm not going to be concerned and worried about three women.
So did they replace you with others? Because I understand that there was a moment, for a while they were without communications until they could figure out how to replace you. Is that right?
That's right, because our battalion commander pulled us right back in and assigned us to another unit, and that unit was the one that took us many miles into the desert, and I'm sure that's where we went into Iraq at.
You were in the desert at that point. Tell us about the conditions there.
Well, at first they did the old wagon wheel, you know, circling, you know, the equipment. They had us in the middle of it, I guess so they can keep eyes on us. Eyes was exactly what was going on, and it was just like everything that we needed to do to relieve ourselves, everything had to be done in the middle. Everybody knew we was going, you know, to the restroom, because we all had to go together to put a curtain together with our ponchos. And this is the conditions that we had.
You developed some health problems as a result of that. Was it that deployment?
Oh, yes, yes. When we came back, noticed that I was, you know, starting to have some issues with memory. I was starting to have issues with being extremely fatigued. There were nights of night sweats. I had a lot of problems with terrible migraines, rashes. We came back with some kind of bacteria, H. pylori. Everything is, of course, being denied, but it's true. That's where most of us start to come back, having health problems and allergies that we never had before. It was just amazing to us how healthy we were when we left, and then we come back, and now all of a sudden we almost can't run 2 miles anymore, you know, to meet the requirements for our PT test.
You, as you said, you faced denial and resistance at first. How is it going for you now? Are you able to get treatment? Have they recognized in your case whatever these illnesses are, whether they call it Gulf War syndrome or not?
Well, you know, they'll never claim that it's Gulf War syndrome or illness, but it's chronic conditions, illness now, and have been diagnosed, you know, with fibromyalgia, which is chronic pain, and that's something no one knows where that came from. Then do have allergies. I also have combat-related PTSD. And then you have issues that affect especially women, reproductive issues.
You do have two children.
Two adults, yes.
Two adult children. But they were young during one of your deployments, and you were married at the time during one of your deployments, and your husband was deployed as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. They were 8 and 9, and we had to leave them. And this was like the first brink of parents leaving, you know, their children behind. And then it was the true test of dual military, you know, leaving together. We both deployed and left, flew out on the same plane.
Who was taking care of the kids?
Well, we had a babysitter because we had to move so fast. We did have a dependent care plan, which is required. What are you going to do with your family, you know, once you deploy, or if you deploy, you have to go. We had that in place, and just when you think you have everything in place, sometimes that even falls apart. And that babysitter that we had for 5 years, we've known her for 5 years with our children and trusted her life. She trusted our children's life with her. Turned out to be the babysitter from hell.
Oh.
And she did some things to mentally damage our children. So
When did you learn about that? Were you deployed at the time, or did you find out?
We were deployed.
So I'm trying to understand this. Just the anxiety of both of you being deployed in combat zones, right, with your children at home. Describe that for me. I can't imagine that anxiety.
You know, I worked in communication, so I did have the opportunity and the privilege to be able to call home, and I allowed that with anybody that we was attached to, that they could call home. And while I was calling and talking to our kids occasionally, I noticed that we weren't the only ones on the telephone. And she was listening, and what she was telling the children was that that wasn't really us on the phone. she was just after more money, just mean, evil. Even went so far to try to sell them, you know, in Mexico, and the deal went bad. And my daughter was the one that told me about all of this when I came home. My mother left North Carolina and went to Texas and picked them up. And luckily that I had already had secondary arrangements made with her, that she was able to do so.
So not only do you have to worry about how they're being treated at home, there's also the concern that you might not come home.
And that was the charge that my husband made, my late husband made, right when we found out we was going to deploy to the Middle East. He and another group of men went and marched to the to our colonel, to our battalion colonel, and told him that if anybody got to go to war, I'm going. My wife is not going. Forgot his wife is a sergeant.
You pulled rank on your husband. Way to go.
Well, you know, of course it caused big arguments at home, but yeah. Of course this was the first time that has ever happened, you know, with the military really facing, right, you know, the possibility of dual military leaving together at the same time.
Patricia Harris has taught more than her husband about the value of women in the military, and her story will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Commander Patricia Harris. She leads the American Legion in North Carolina. We talked about your discrimination against you as a woman. What about as an African-American? Did you experience discrimination there as well?
You know, the funniest thing is when someone, when I made the decision, finally made the decision after much prayer and consideration over a year of thought, and I kind of kicked it around with some of the, you know, some of the other legionnaires and senior legionnaires. And they said, well, you know what's wrong with you? And I said, what is it? Well, you're black and you're a woman. And I'm like, really? So what about if I say something was wrong with you? You know, this is who I am. I can't change that. Yes, that was always a point. And at this point now, I'm not really sure if it was so much about being an African-American as it is about being a woman.
Well, talk about that, because to be the commander of an American Legion, it's not just the post, right? This is North Carolina.
This is the state.
This is the whole state. So you had to campaign for this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, tell us about that campaign. That must be extraordinary.
Well, you know, a wise old past department commander told me that, and he since passed on, he said, you'll never know until you try. North Carolina is a hard nut to crack. And he said people got a lot of old ideas about things. And I knew where he was getting at. That was very, very interesting. There were areas, you know, in North Carolina that I had to go. And some of them weren't quite as friendly, you know, when I showed up. And I think that the only reason why they were was because I came in with another group of others, because we followed our past department commander, the one that just served, you know, just a year before me on the campaign trail. And, of course, they let him in and everybody else then, you know, and I'm coming in too, so they already knew I was doing it. But, yes, that was an issue with some of the places that I've gone to. And I think that also that the reason why they weren't really ugly about it was because I am a Legionnaire. And if nothing else, I'm still a veteran. And I served just like they served. And maybe that might have been just the edge that I needed to keep them from being that ugly. But it was some very testy times, you know, going from different places. And many of them, I was the only woman in that group. Many of them, I might have been the only woman and African-American.
I can see how that common experience, combat duty, having served in the same military, might keep them from being ugly. But how did you get them to vote for you? What was the campaign? What was it about you and what you were promising that actually turned into votes?
I think people wanted to look at someone real. They wanted to look at someone that was qualified. I think one of the greatest things in the world is competition, because people that go uncontested, then we have to settle for whatever it is or whoever it is. But when you have two candidates, then you have two people that want the same job to do the right thing, supposedly the right thing, for the right reasons for all of the Legionnaires that's in this state, which is nearly 40,000 of them. They wanted someone that could relate to where we're trying to go now with membership. We need younger people. We need the new ones that are here now, that are serving right now. We need the Iraqi and Afghanistan. We need everybody. We need the Gulf War. And then at the same time, they wanted someone that probably had some roots, you know, in it. It like I said, it wasn't easy. And I knew the whole way through, I had been told that it was going to be close. That was very surprising to me. That to hear that it was going to be a close race, because it made me think that, okay, maybe we are ready for change. Maybe we are ready to get up with the with what's going on right now, because we have women that are fighting each and every day. They're getting hurt. They're being maimed. They're facing so many different challenges. Myself, you know, I could relate to the other women that have MST in their background, as well as some combat, or those that have not. It's just a...
MST?
Military sexual trauma.
You were assaulted?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have. Been kidnapped, been raped, and harassed a lot.
How were you able to go back? I mean, I think you put it poetically, these are people who are supposed to have your back. When that kind of, when that happens, how can you go back and serve again with those same people?
Well, you know, it was different rules, especially in my time. There were different rules because most of the time they look at the guys and they look at his career and that he has a family. So you don't really matter. You don't matter.
You have a family. You have a family.
Absolutely. But at the time when those things were happening, the worst part of it, it was just me. It was just me and then my parents, because I was so young, 18, 19 years old, with the kidnapping happened by a staff sergeant. Okay, so he has a family. And shouldn't he have consideration in that as well with himself, with his actions? But I thought that for many of them, they saw women, you know, being in the military where you're asking for it. No, I'm not. I just want to serve my country. And even to the point that I'm willing to die for it. But at the same time, I had to make a decision. Will I allow them to put me out of the military because I'm bringing this charge up and I already know where this is going? Or do I just do like most of us do, suck it up and drive on? Just leave me alone. I hope you'll leave me alone, but we'll suck it up and we'll drive on.
You didn't. You brought charges.
Well, my dad made me do the first one with the kidnapping. He did. Drove me right back to Fort Jackson. He took me straight back there. And it was only until I left and went to Fort Polk, and then I was told to come back, that this guy had did this to about 8 other females. But he has since passed. He did.
Was he disciplined?
Oh, very much so. I think he did about 10 years at Fort Leavenworth, And then when he was discharged, or he finished his time, came home and girlfriend stabbed him in the heart with a screwdriver, what I understood later. Wow. Too bad.
But what's significant here among the many elements of this that are extraordinary is that seven or eight other women had had this happen to them, and they made the decision that you were about to make, which is suck it up and drive on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And unless you had come back, he may have done it 8 or 9
My
more
dad
times.
made me do it on that case, yes.
Yeah.
And it was a long process. But I think that I did try to suck it up and drive on, because anytime, you know, you start to show emotion or you start to slow down, like you're not going to be able to handle it, do your job and handle it, that's when you have your platoon sergeants and, you know, your section sergeants start to get on your case. And then there's no telling what they would recommend to happen to you, not knowing that something happened to this soldier here. And it's just like no one cares, but I can't tell you, because if I do, you might punish me. Oh, she's going to go and put this person get this person written up or disciplined, you know, for making a pass at her. And I'm trying to figure out, well, what was so attractive? Was it the uniform? You know, it wasn't like it was too tight. What was it?
So here you are blaming yourself.
Which usually that's what we do. I went straight to myself and said, well, I wonder what was it? You know, was it perfume? You know, was it hair? You know, what was it?
Are things changing now? Is it better for women? Do they not have to blame themselves? Can they understand that this is simply wrong and men shouldn't be doing this?
I think inside we do know that, but there's still some of us that will still look in within ourselves. You know, what did we do?
What about the military itself? Is it taking these charges more seriously and making it easier for women?
I think that they're addressing it. Well, they have such a long way to go with that. And that's one of the things that the American Legion has really been harping on, supporting the measures to stop, you know, to stop that harassment, to stop that violence, you know, with the women and holding people accountable. And it's hard to do that unless you feel safe that you can do it. And from the rape, no, I did not feel safe because it was too close. It was just too close to my family to reveal that person for that to happen. And my husband left this earth, you know, not knowing a lot of things, because I know he was not going to be able to handle it, but I had to handle it.
So you didn't tell him, and your husband passed, not in combat.
No, he wasn't in combat.
And so you didn't tell him. He didn't know?
He did not know about some of the other things that happened, the harassments, especially out there, even in the war. Spending time in the foxhole with you guys, the jokes. Well, you know, if you put yourself in that kind of situation, you know, and I have a good sense of humor, and I understand that I do work around a lot of men, and there are some things, you know, that they'll say that really it might bother some women, but it wouldn't bother me. But then there are other times that they can kind of go a little bit too far about that. And with that, where it's uncomfortable, then yes, I will say something about that. But it just depends on your tolerance level on what it is that you're going to be willing to put up with.
You started a program for women, right?
Who have
returned. Tell us about it.
The Women Veteran Support Services. We're a crisis intervention program. We assist when women just need a sister on the line. She need to talk to someone in the middle of the night when all of the other agencies may be closed. We do a lot of referrals. We do not try to go and reinvent the wheel. There's no need to do that, but we are very, very unique in our ways, because one thing about it, most of us have served, we're women that have served as well, so we definitely understand the plight.
What are some of the challenges for women returning?
Well, they're always going to need that support system to try to help reintegrate them back into civilian life. Then there's an issue. There are issues that haven't been addressed. Those things that had that we had to suck up and drive on with. Some point or another, that's going to come out, and it has to. So we want to make sure that we get the women involved so they can at least start to open up that Pandora's box on their own instead of allowing it to fly open and then all sorts of things come out.
It's interesting. You say that now you've had this program for women, but you're finding that men are coming to you as well.
Most households, single households, you know, that we know of, most of them are hit by the women, but now we're finding that there are a lot of males that are being head of households, you know, with little girls that run into problems near homelessness. One of the things that I don't like in our system with most of the shelters that we see a lot of problems is that the age limits and the restrictions that they cause, you know, when you have families in there together. A mother could come in with two children and she have maybe two little boys. One is two, the other one is 10. The 10-year-old is not going to be able to be with his mother and his brother because of the age restriction in most of the shelters. So the little boy, the 9-year-old, need to go into more the male population. I don't know any mother or any father that's going to allow their child, you know, their family to be separated like that. And so one of the things that we try to do, and we use a lot of the resources, especially through the American Legion too, to try to keep those families together.
Does that mean creating different shelters or just finding shelters that are don't have the age limits?
This a little bit of both. Like again, like I said, we don't want to try to recreate a will. You know, if it's out there, then we'd like to know about it so we can refer people, you know, families to them. But those are big challenges, you know, for both male and female. Of course, you know, women are not the only ones that go through military sexual trauma. We have men that come through that as well, and they have issues and they have families. And sometimes, when the men hurt, their hurt is much like ours, but yes, we can relate to each other, you know, about it. But joblessness among veterans, that is just really ridiculous here as it is across the nation. We like to see more jobs, you know, being available, you know, for them. That would help and aid through this the homelessness and the other challenges that the women, have become a big major in numbers, you know, with not seeking adequate jobs.
You talked about being in high school and on the way to the military or having to make this choice, and a counselor, I think, told you, look, you can always be a hairdresser afterward. Here's your chance. When you came back, did you become a hairdresser?
Yes, I went to school. I went to Dudley's Cosmetology University in Kernersville when they had it there, and did very well in it. Worked at it for about 5-6 years.
Still doing it?
No, I'm not able to do it. For me, it was a lot of triggers that was involved, and it had a lot to do with memories of smells. From hair, you know, getting caught in stoves or anything that was burning was starting to get to me. And it just affected me too much to the point that it's not going to be able to continue to keep that trade up.
Yeah, PTSD triggers, you're saying.
Oh, yes.
So your father said that you could only wear as a young woman that hat for 2 minutes until you earned it. What is it like for you now to be able to wear that hat as long as you want?
It is an honor to be able to be a Legionnaire, and for someone to say Legionnaire and call you one is even a greater honor. Leading the organization, the American Legion in this state, is very, very rewarding. And it was more than I would have ever thought, you know, for myself. If my father was alive, I'm sure he would have been very proud of me of that. But I'm very, very proud of the state of North Carolina, because they did put me here, and I just want to be the best representative and to let everyone know that it is not the way that they used to think about the American Legion. They used to think it was all male, all white, old, big, heavy, old local watering hole. No, they do have some posts that do have lounge and canteens in them, but that's not what the American Legion is about. The American Legion is the largest veteran organization, you know, in the States and in the world, really. It is a organization that is more family oriented. It's something for everybody. The women, you know, we have our auxiliary, we have the Legion Riders that support us, and that's, you know, the guys on the motor and girls on the motorcycles that raise a lot of money. Then we have our sons, you know, the American Legion, and they are big fundraisers, you know, for our programs that we have. The American Legion also is the reason why we had the GI Bill. You know, we had a legionnaire that penned that. And the VA, the VA healthcare system, need to have somewhere to take care of our veterans.
Commander Harris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patricia Harris is the commander of the American Legion Department of North Carolina. Coming up, two veterans create businesses to make jobs for fellow vets. Stay with us.